Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Today we will hear more from journalist Dar Jamail of Anchorage, Alaska, a U.S.-based independent journalist when he went to Iraq in 2003. Dar Jamail joined me for an hour February 13, 2006, to talk about what the headlines look like from the U.S. side of the Atlantic. Dar Jamail has also been writing about the possibility of a U.S. attack on Iran and possible reactions to this in Iraq, of a Shiite uprising and other complications in an already chaotic security situation. We spoke about Iran's scheduled change this March from dealing oil in dollars to dealing oil in euros instead. Here is a portion of what he said.
If we look back even just before the U.S. invaded Iraq, and we look at why there was such a race to get in there as quickly as possible, is because Saddam Hussein was already making moves to start trading his oil in euros rather than the U.S. dollar. And if we look at what's happening in Iran now, as you mentioned, they are moving towards the oil bourse, which is a more pro-euro oil trading mechanism rather than U.S. dollars. And if this occurs, and it is slated to occur by the end of March, which not so coincidentally has been a date set by the Israeli government as a cutoff date that they feel that they have to begin aggressive military action towards Iran if they don't, quote-unquote, disarm and stop with their nuclear program prior to that date. So it's an interesting coincidence that they would pick the end of March for this, which seems like an arbitrary date until we contextualize it with the oil bourse. Because a currency switch with Iran, they are the fourth largest reserves now on the planet. This would be a catastrophic blow to the value of the U.S. dollar. And really, the U.S. as an empire, as the sole world superpower, could not afford that. Our economy is already in shambles. We already have over $8 trillion of debt. This economy relies on $2 billion of foreign currency to be injected into it on a daily basis just to maintain itself. So we have a burgeoning debt. We operate at a constant deficit. And to have a large segment of the oil being traded in any currency other than U.S. dollars would probably be an unrecoverable blow to the U.S. And I think that's another thing that makes an attack on Iran imminent. And I think if it happens at the end of March, assuming Iran keeps moving forward with the oil bourse, if an attack happens, therefore, at the end of March, it really wouldn't be surprising.
We will now hear part two of the February 13th interview with Dar Jamail, picking up from where we left off on the subject of Iran and starting with my first question for Dar about the MEK, Mujahideen El-Kek, that has received some U.S. support and is located in Iraq at the Iran border. We've had several people on this program talking about an organization known as the Mujahideen El-Kek. They are said to be located now very near or at the Iranian border with Iran. And there have been indications that there are some good number of these people, thousands, according to Khan Hallinan. I spoke with Scott Ritter about this, and he went into some of the history and pointed out that the Mujahideen El-Kek, or MEK, was actually involved in the taking of the U.S. hostages back when Jimmy Carter was president. So we seem to be spinning round and round with our policies in this region, and I just wondered, comment on events on the ground. Should the U.S. attack Iran, and what kinds of things might also be happening in terms of cross-border operations?
Well, the Mujahideen al-Kek are actually under U.S. arrest right now in Iraq. The U.S. military there is well aware of the fact that many of these individuals who are in Iraq, of course there are some still in Iran, but they essentially are being guarded very closely. They're not allowed to have any weapons, and they are essentially probably being used right now by the U.S. to launch subversive operations inside of Iran. And I don't think that's really the biggest concern when the bombs start to fall on Iran. I think the biggest concern will be, and I imagine Mr. Ritter spoke of this, I've heard him speak of this several other times, and I totally agree with him in talking about the fact that there will be a Shia uprising in Iraq, because right now, as we discussed earlier on the program, the dominant Shia bloc in the new Iraqi government, which now is officially in power, they are essentially controlled by Iran. Muqtada al-Sadr has also expressed his allegiance with Iran if the U.S. And or Israel begins dropping bombs on Iran. So I think we will see an immediate giant Shia uprising in Iraq, and I think that has many, many military planners in the U.S. very, very concerned. And I think it's important to note another parallel, like we had before the invasion of Iraq. We had many high-ranking members, high-ranking U.S. brass in the U.S. military who were very against an invasion at that time. We had others who were very against invading Iraq as they did and not having a post-war plan. Similarly, we have many, many high-ranking intelligence officials and military officials saying, no, we can't do anything more aggressive in the region now. This is why we have individuals like Representative Murtha coming out, voicing the opinion of top Army generals in the U.S. military who are saying, look, our military is broken. We're sorely overstretched. We need to pull out. We can't maintain even the occupation of Iraq. So all that said, it would be absolute lunacy to drop bombs and launch an aggressive operation of any sort against Iran at this stage for the U.S. military. But keeping in mind these people dictating the Bush policy, people like Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Condoleezza Rice, Richard Pearl, Karl Rove, these are individuals that I think it's a no-brainer at this point to say that they're not operating with logic. We can't apply logic here, otherwise we never would have invaded Iraq to begin with. So why change course? They have their agenda. It's made out quite clear in the Project for the New American Century, and Iran is simply next on their agenda. And I don't think that short of a massive uprising here amongst the population of essentially some sort of movement to force these individuals from power and replace them with more reasonable people. I really don't see anything stopping an attack on Iran, which of course would draw Syria into the fight, which would basically create complete upheaval inside of Iraq as well.
Let's look at some of the arguments that are naturally going to come up, and I've actually heard a few of these on NPR in particular. The analysis is that if the U.S. fails, accepts failure in Iraq, and leaves, that will encourage others in the region to assume the same kinds of tactics, to witness Afghanistan already doing the same thing. This is being attributed to the Taliban or drug warlords in operating in Afghanistan. But people are now, again, analyzing the failure of the U.S. How will this be interpreted by various forces we would now be calling our enemies if we were using the language of the Donald Rumsfelds of the world? These are very dangerous times. If I'm understanding events correctly, we could wind up in a world war without foreseeable end dates, because if you're talking about using even potentially unconventional weapons, there certainly seems to be the potential there that was stressed by both Con Hallinan and Scott Ritter. So, Dar, if we're facing all of these potential disasters by attacking, what about ways to use alternate means of solving the problem? I know Iran has delayed at least its option of, going to Russia to have Russia enrich uranium for the country to produce power. But there seems to be a lot going on behind the scenes, people doing all sorts of power plays. Just talk about a happier outcome here. What could we possibly hope for in your mind?
I think, and this is really simply just to speculate, because it's really not based in reality, as far as a solution. And I think this will come off as a bit cynical, but I think short of, as I said before, a complete regime change here at home, this is essentially a pipe dream. But what I would propose as a solution in the region is essentially what was proposed by the World Tribunal on Iraq in the culminating session, which took place last summer in Istanbul, Turkey, which was a full, immediate, unconditional withdrawal of all occupation forces from Iraq, just for starters. But not just that, that coupled with a simultaneous full compensation being paid out to every Iraqi who suffered damage or loss of a loved one as a result of the invasion or occupation. And then not just that, but all remaining reconstruction funds and contracts turned over to Iraqi concerns, giving them full control of rebuilding their own country. This would immediately cause a drastic drop in the unemployment rate. It would immediately take the wind out of the sails of the resistance, which is growing in support daily because the situation there is so despicable to people. But if you altered that by, A, taking out the leading cause of death and instability of Iraq and in the region, remove them from Iraq, pay out full compensation for damage done, and turn over all reconstruction contracts to Iraqis, this would be a good first step in not necessarily salvaging the U.S. reputation in the Middle East, but at least essentially a first step towards that direction. I think we could draw a very rough analogy of if someone is essentially been stabbed, then if you just simply pull the knife out, that's obviously the first thing you have to do if we're going to get this person healed. Then we can start working on, okay, what kind of medical treatment are they going to need? What kind of medications will they need? This sort of thing. So I think essentially the biggest damage done in recent years in the Middle East has obviously been the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And until that can happen and essentially leave these people alone, there's really not going to be any solution that we can talk about. And another thing I should add, that when I was at this Al Jazeera forum recently in Doha, Qatar, that was what one Arab scholar and Arab media personality after another on this stage in these different panel discussions was saying is, why don't you just leave us alone? You know, leave us alone to sort out our own problems. Yes, things are not perfect here, just like things are not perfect in the United States, where we have a quarter of the population living in abject poverty, almost half the population without any sort of health insurance. So this isn't exactly the perfect society either. Neither are societies over in the Middle East, but they just want to be left alone. They don't want to be occupied. They don't want giant military bases in their backyards. They don't want the sound of U.S. fighter planes scorching their skies every single day. And they don't want Western businesses operating there. They want to have their own chance to have their own life without the direct influence of U.S. imperialism. And until that begins to happen, any talk of a solution or justice in the Middle East or repairing a U.S. reputation is a waste of time.
I do want to talk a little bit about the video that was recently shown on Democracy Now. These are British forces beating young Iraqis. And in the background, you hear the observer, presumably the person taking the video, making some of the most frightening sounds and statements that I have ever heard. It was like a horror movie, really, to listen to this. And here's a man egging on, you know, cheering the kicks and blows being delivered. Unbelievable, Dar. Just talk about the way the U.S. forces in Iraq are in terms of how long they've been there, the state of mind they must be in, and how that would factor into a widening of this war into Iran. I mean, can we really predict what could happen if this takes place?
This video, and I've seen that video myself, it is horrific, but it's really not surprising to me. If we look at all occupations throughout history, the best known and longer occupation of the Israeli military occupation of Palestine, and we look at the ongoing abuse being meted out by Israeli soldiers against Palestinians, we have torture going on there. We've had people detained for years on end with no reason whatsoever. We have a total dehumanization of a people going on. And essentially every occupying army, this begins to happen to them. This started to happen with U.S. soldiers in Vietnam, where it's the dehumanization process of the enemy. All of a sudden now we see Iraqis being treated as subhuman. But we have the atrocities of Abu Ghraib, which are ongoing, I should be very clear about. There are thousands more photographs and hours of video footage of other beatings by U.S. soldiers as well that have never been allowed to be put on the air in this country. So this British video, taken in that light, it's really not surprising. This is an ongoing reality in Iraq where we have an occupation army that thinks it's above the law, and because actually, literally, they know that they're above the law in Iraq. They've changed all the laws to where they're completely immune to any Iraqi courts and certainly to international law. The U.S. military is not a member of the International Criminal Court, so nothing, therefore, can happen to U.S. military personnel in Iraq. They're essentially given free license, free rein to behave any way that they want. People are being killed by them on a daily basis, and they don't have to answer to anyone. Just to give you an idea, there was a recent trial of a U.S. soldier back here in the United States. It was the same week that some activists were put on trial for an action they took in a military recruitment station just before the invasion of Iraq. These are four U.S. citizens that went in and poured some of their own blood along the walls of a recruiting station in the U.S. They were tried in federal prison, each of them sentenced anywhere from 4 to 6 months in a federal prison for pouring their own blood on the walls of a military recruiting station 2 days before the invasion of Iraq began. In the same week of that trial, a U.S. soldier was put on trial for literally killing an Iraqi general. He received no time in prison. He received 2 weeks of mandatory staying at his home, and then some probation time tacked on to that. So that gives you an idea of the type of justice U.S. soldiers, even those found guilty of killing high-ranking members of the Iraqi military inside their own country of Iraq, they know that. They're well aware that they can essentially get away with murder. So atrocities like the beating of these younger Iraqi men by British soldiers, or atrocities of the torturing and humiliation being meted out in Abu Ghraib, it's a daily life in occupied Iraq. It's a daily reality for Iraqis in the zone of the occupation now, and it is ongoing, and it's something that's simply not going to stop until the occupation ends.
Dar, finally, let's talk about some of what's going on at home as a backdrop to all of this violence. We see more and more coming out about corruption and about people like Jack Abramoff, Ralph Reed, others who have been touted as, you know, the bright hope of the Republican Party in terms of fundraising, and yet wound up breaking the law. The president has tried to distance himself, and yet there are pictures of him and others with Jack Abramoff. And these are stories that are just not going away, and they're having an impact. Then there are the hearings about Hurricane Katrina and the government's slow response. And finally, we see the Congress standing up and asking questions about violations of the law where the NSA was instructed to spy on Americans. Looking at all of this, it does seem that there is a somewhat increased responsiveness toward trying to improve the rule of law in America. Do you see that as something that is actually hopeful in terms of pulling or reining in the Bush administration?
I think it's a start, but I'm actually not, I have to admit that I'm not extremely hopeful, because the bottom line is we still have a lapdog media here. We have a corporate media that, really the issue has been allowed to, the discourses around corruption, links between Bush and Abramoff, what's happening with Louis Libby, and what happened to the discussion about lying to an entire country in order to generate support to back a U.S. illegal U.S. invasion of a sovereign country of Iraq. What happened to discussion about over 100,000 Iraqis and over 2,000 U.S. soldiers being killed as a direct result of these lies. What happened to discussion around fraudulent election of 2000 in this country? What happened to discussion around Bush's very, very direct links with Kinlay and Enron? What happened to, I mean, we can just go on down the list. It's been one scandal after another with this Bush administration and individuals involved in it. And the fact that it's focusing, in my opinion, in a distracted and almost more light way on things like a corruption scandal and a lobbyist scandal and this sort of thing, it's rather insulting to those of us who are concerned with the bigger picture. I think people like you and probably most of the listeners of your program, where I think there's a lot more at stake than who received what kind of corrupt lobbying money from a lobbyist like Abramoff. I think until the media starts asking these repeated tough questions and doing their job and giving people the information they need to make better choices, we're really not going to see any change. This Abramoff thing is yet another giant scandal which is liable to blow over. I think the real question will be is if someone like Bush or Cheney or any other high-ranking member of his administration is forced to directly resign as a result of this, then maybe we'll be getting somewhere. But until that happens, until we have a legitimate move towards impeachment of someone sitting in the office of president who is without a doubt directly responsible for the whole situation, the whole catastrophe in Iraq, and is responsible for every death that's occurred there as a result, until justice starts to happen on that front, I think we're a bit off track in this country.
Finally, Dar, why don't we end by talking about the issue of war crimes tribunals that you've participated in. I saw you on the BBC, and this was Newsnight. Why don't you start by talking about that, and then perhaps we can hear more about the tribunal in New York.
The BBC Newsnight program shows Monday through Friday on the evenings over in the BBC in the UK. According to the BBC, it is their most watched news program, and they actually, I commend them for taking the step of actually having a program called The Allies on Trial. And it's essentially they did in a very brief one-hour period, but they brought up numerous aspects of the occupation of Iraq, like illegal weapons used in torture, as well as other issues such as the CIA kidnapping people and shipping them across the world to be tortured. So all of these matters were discussed. I was there to provide testimony about war crimes in Fallujah. I discussed the deliberate targeting of civilians by U.S. military snipers, as well as illegal weapons being used. And it was just important to me that the BBC would at least take the step to bring this discussion of war crimes and the Allies on Trial and violations of international law, just to mention these terms to such a broad audience, I think was at least a step in the right direction, one that mainstream media here would do itself good to follow. More recently, there was a war crimes commission in New York City. It was sponsored by the Not in Our Name coalition of anti-war groups, and they brought together a quite impressive list of people to provide testimony of crimes this Bush administration has committed, and not just with Iraq, but I'll start there and move onwards, where they brought in people like me and Jeremy Scahill to testify about war crimes in Iraq, both before, during, and after the invasion, where, of course, the Bush administration is directly responsible for this and should be tried accordingly. They had individuals like the former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, who testified about the CIA using extraordinary rendition to bring people to that country to be tortured by Uzbek security forces. Scott Ritter provided testimony. Former Brigadier General Janet Karpinski, who was in charge of Abu Ghraib, provided testimony about ongoing torture in Iraq. So it was quite an impressive list, on down to Hurricane Katrina survivors and other people also testifying about Bush policy regarding what are they doing to prevent the spread of AIDS in Africa. So a broad spectrum of topics was covered, and essentially testimony was heard. Most oftentimes it was expert testimony provided. This was made available to the public, and in sum, without a doubt, this administration is guilty not only of war crimes in Iraq and countless breaches of international law and the Geneva Conventions, but also essentially have been accused of genocide by their policies regarding AIDS and what they've done regarding Africa. Of course, they have lied blatantly about trying to do things to help the situation in Africa, while on the other hand, they've really done nothing but cut funding and put in jeopardy other programs that are designed to help people there and stave off the spread of AIDS. On down the line. So not just Iraq, but their policies and how they're affecting Africa and global warming and on down the line, pick a topic essentially was covered, and they have essentially been found guilty of illegal invasions and jeopardizing life on the planet, if you will, and should be brought to account.
Going just back to England for the moment, just to point out that the BBC's audience and the people set up as judges in this trial of the Allies for war crimes found the Allies guilty, right? Just wanted to make that point. Where you spoke about endangering people, putting lives at risk, putting the very planet at risk, what do you make of the Prime Minister of England accepting now the information that is available on global warming, looking at it as a potential catastrophe and saying we basically have roughly 7 years to save the planet?
Mr. Blair has said this sort of thing in the past where, of course, it's good and it's a positive thing to at least admit that, yes, we are in a dire crisis and steps need to be taken immediately to avert what could be global catastrophe regarding global warming, and that he at least acknowledges this is good. But I've seen him do this in the past where he'll acknowledge this, and the bottom line is, unless they take the initiative to start changing things dramatically and pressure the Bush administration to do the same, since the U.S. is one of the leading polluters on the planet and Bush policy has done nothing but strip away environmental regulations, unless Blair can essentially put his money where his mouth is, I think it's just empty political rhetoric. What are they doing, of course, in regards to having such close ties to the Bush administration? Blair is in a unique position to pressure them to change the policy here in the U.S. and is simply not doing so, just like he's in a quite unique position to pressure the Bush administration to change its horribly flawed policy in Iraq, and of course he's not doing so.
I know that in Iraq you had events proceeding at a rapid pace and dangerously so, and we're reporting just all the time, really, about this. But what's it like to be back home, Dar, and to have to try to keep up with the whole spectrum of where we are in this crisis of history?
I think that what I'm dealing with isn't, now that I've been back in the U.S. for almost a year, reporting on the situation from this side of the Atlantic rather than over in Iraq, and I think that anyone that really avails themselves of the information and uses the internet and really stays up on things as best they can, I think is in a similar position as I am, which is, you know, we are citizens of a country that is in a massive political crisis. Our government is 100% corrupted. It's been hijacked by a cadre of people who are essentially corporate pawns, acting in only the best interest of corporations in this country, not for the average citizen here. And we're at a make or break point where I think people have to decide what are they willing to do in order to not just take responsibility for changing the course of this country, but really the fate of the world is in large part at stake, where the policies of this government affect the world so directly and so strongly that really I feel like we are in the front lines here of that fight. And anyone who's not politically involved at this point, I wonder what they're waiting for. How much worse does it need to get before more people decide it's time to start taking action, get involved, start doing what they can to affect some change? And I feel that I'm in that same situation here. I think, you know, each person needs to decide whether they're going to stay in this country and try to change things from inside, which we are in a unique position, theoretically anyway, to be able to do so. And I think that it's very important for people to consider what are they willing to do, because if people don't, decide that it's time to make that change now, pretty soon I'm afraid it might be too late.
Dar Jamail, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dori.
We've been speaking with journalist Dar Jamail, who covered the war in Iraq for 8 months in Baghdad, Fallujah, and other parts of the country, touching on torture going on in U.S.-run prisons in Iraq well before the mainstream press in America took on that subject. For more information on his work, you can visit his website at darjamailiraq.com, darjamailiraq.com. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced at WHUS Stores, radio for the people at UConn. You can listen to this program live Wednesdays at 5 p.m., online at whus.org, and try talknation.org for transcripts and discussion.